Well, it's time now that we go across town to the delightfully air-cooled, beautifully appointed Gourmet Club.
Ray, yes? You know that young squirt that we hired last week?
Wilbur Conley?
Yes, he just handed me a note saying that the Gourmet Club has moved temporarily while they're redecorating.
Did that young squirt move it on his own?
No, he had nothing to do with it, but they're next door, so it may sound a little bit different. I don't know if their microphones
are all right, then, and thank you, Wilbur, for telling us, and so we take you to our two correspondents at the Gourmet Club.
Good afternoon, and good morning, and good luck to the public. We are broadcasting from a Gourmet Club. Not the regular one, however. We have had to move because the heating plant broke down at the beautifully appointed regular Gourmet Club.
And while we're repairing that and painting and other decorations, we have kindly been given the facilities of a restaurant next door. All of the regular members of the Gourmet Club are here, together with quite a few others. And everyone seems to be enjoying themselves.
That's right. This is a Chinese chop house. We're in steaks, French fries, the principal main attraction, although Chinese dishes will be served if you so desire.
The annual feature of the day will be the Gourmet Club egg roll, in which everyone will participate, and we hope have a good time.
All the younger fry who make up part of our membership will participate in that. By looking about the room, I noticed, let me see, Charlie Chan is here.
Sabu is here, too, today.
Von Monroe has joined the happy singing at the stage. You can probably hear our dear friend.
Well, there's the fanfare which signals the arrival of our sandwich surprise, the sandwich of a famous person to be opened in public ceremony.
Gee whiz, Harry, I wonder would it be possible for them to quiet down during the opening of the sandwich. Thank
they
you.
They definitely have heard us because they have quieted down considerably.
We want to thank the uniformed guide for bringing the sandwich up on the stage. It's in a brown paper bag in waxed paper. We open that. And first of all, do you have the envelope, Harry?
Yes, the envelope has been torn open, and the sandwich belongs to Bill Boyd, Hopalong Cassidy.
Fair enough. His sandwich is beaten biscuit and ham. Well, congratulations to Bill Boyd. You can hear a buzz throughout the Gourmet Club at the announcement of the sandwich belonging to Bill Boyd.
Now, as everyone resumes their gay festivities here, the dancing begins once again, and it's just about time to say goodbye.
And on this happy, pleasant note, sincere wishes from the Gourmet Club to you all.
And in turn, immediately switching to Belfast, Maine, seen today of the famous Belfast Balloon Ascension and correspondent W.W. Ballou and Artie Skirmahorn.
W. Ballou with Artie Skirmahorn speaking here from the town park in Belfast, Maine, where the annual balloon ascension is about to take place. The balloon over there is being inflated right at the present moment, and I think Artie Skirmahorn is in a better position to see just how far it has gone to this point. Will you come in, Artie?
Horn here, and it's just about ready now to go into the air. I was talking with the chairman of the get-together today. He tells me that there will be approximately 100 pounds of stuff going into that balloon. He didn't say what type of chemical it is.
Hello here. Excuse me, Artie, but I think it was 500 pounds because anybody knows that they couldn't get the balloon off the ground without sufficient pressure.
Well, don't mean to interrupt you again, Wally, but I am of the opinion that it's less than that. However, maybe you have figures a little later than mine. Well taken.
Malou, and I can see from here that I think they're about to wave the flag, which means they have inflated it to the extremity they had planned. The fellow is looking at the basket.
wasn't well, that too bad.
What do you see from there, Artie? Anything?
It just disintegrated completely. Nobody's hurt or anything, but it's just ruined.
They have a spare, I'm told, and they will get to work on that right away and start inflating the second one.
The townsfolks are now walking slowly toward their home. Take you now somewhere in Manhattan into a sightseeing bus.
All right, folks, if you'll just sit back and relax now, we're traveling down Fifth Avenue, which is known as one of the main thoroughfares of Manhattan, east of Fifth, the numbers are called
Clarence,
east, west of Fifth.
Clarence,
yes?
This is Madison Avenue. I don't mean to correct you in front of all of us.
Down Madison Avenue here. We're going south and we'll be turning right in just a few moments on to
Clarence, we're traveling north and we'll have to make a left turn up here at an even number street.
We'll make a left turn on a westbound street. All of the westbound streets go west and the eastbound streets go east. Therefore, if we're going north, we make a left turn.
I'm afraid you're wrong. I have a little rule of thumb I use, even east.
Will you tend to your driving, please, Harry, and let me tend to my sightseeing thought?
I know, but I can't.
Over there, you'll see the site of one of the most famous restaurants here in New York, and I don't remember the name of it.
I don't think the sign could be much bigger, Clarence.
The sign was taken down, Harry, to be repaired earlier this week.
Well, we've only passed it every day of our lives.
Now we're crossing Fifth Avenue, ladies and gentlemen. Up to the right, you'll see Central Park. It stretches for a good many blocks from 59th Street north and about three blocks from 5th Avenue west, I think. I'll check that for you. If you'll just slow down a little bit, Harry. You're going a little
bit. You describe what we're passing. I'll do the driving, Clarence. I think that would be a fair arrangement.
That's what I've been trying to do, Harry, ever since we set out on this trip. You're absolutely the worst person to work with on one of these sightseeing tours that I've ever had the...
I think if you describe to the people who are what we're doing here, I think they'd think they were getting more for their money than listening to you argue with me, Clarence.
We're turning left into what is known as the Great White Way.
This is not the Great White Way. It will be 10 blocks before we're at the
You're right. I did make a mistake on that. It looked like Times Square to me, but it wasn't. It was Columbus Circle. And over there you'll see the preparations for a great amphitheater and
That's a statue of Christopher Columbus, everybody.
The circle is named after Christopher Columbus, obviously, and anyone who'd ever seen his picture or his statue would know who is that fellow in the statue.
Hold on to your hats. I'm going to make a right turn.
We're turning right now.
And right here we have three gentlemen, two garbed in native Bernese or Bernuses, and the third, an interpreter for this group of Arabians. Is that right, sir? You're Mr. Spivak, aren't you?
That's right.
And you have brought these this ace Arabian drill team to this country.
Mm-hmm.
What is the aim of this tour?
Close order drill.
And they do some of the most unusual close-order drilling that I've ever seen. I'll say that for them. I saw them rehearsing.
They do all the customary left-right faces by the right flank, column rights, column lefts, with a few to the wind's march.
You're the interpreter for them. You do speak Arabian, is that right?
Yes, I do. I'll give the commands and tell you what I just said.
All right. Well, now, how many are there in this drill team?
18.
18. And they're all lined up?
A small platoon.
Standing at attention there. And what is the first thing we will hear, Mr. Spivak?
This.
Report!
The leader.
I'm just giving the order. Forward march.
Report!
That was by the left flank march.
Report!
Now, two.
Report!
Two on each end are going off to the wings.
Report!
Yeah, sound a little familiar. I noticed that the two on each end, now there's two more on each end, have dropped off and gone into the wings.
Well, that was my fault.
That leaves 10 on...
There are 10 of these 8th Arabian drill team
members. For fight!
Or rather, 8 left on stage there.
For fight!
By the left flank, Morris.
Now, 4 to one side.
Fire that!
A very complicated maneuver here,
that
I should...
keep in step.
Well, now there, four just went off the stage right there, didn't they?
Yes. It's a very small...
The two members of the team are still marching here and...
Fire that!
Where did that other one go?
Run off to the wing. I'm all alone here. I got to bring myself to a halt.
Oh, that's you.
Wait!
I just said halt to me.
Well, very good. I understood that last command there. Where do you expect to take these people?
Well, just before we went on the air, we had a call from Ed Sullivan, like it's on his...
On the show?
Television show.
Oh, well, swell. I hope that you have a great deal of success, if you can find them.
And they'll be all right.
Right. Thanks, Mr. Spivak. Spotlight on the advertising field now. As I understand it, I just met this gentleman a few minutes before we went on the air. What is your name?
Stephen Delfinity.
Mr. Delfinity, what is it that you do that is connected with advertising?
I train dogs for the advertising agency.
Well, now, this is kind of doesn't make sense, just hearing it off the bat like this. So just how does this work?
Well, it's principally... You're Bob, right?
That's right.
It's principally Bob for the advertising agencies who sponsor football games. What I do is I train dogs to be used at those games.
You train dogs to be used at football games?
At football games.
Well, this demands a little more explanation, I think. How do you do it, and what do you train them for?
Yes, what I do is I have all types of dogs. I have Cocker Spaniels. I have a big boxer I use in big bowl games. I have several types of dogs. What I do is I train them to run on the field and delay the game so that they can get more commercials in during the actual football game.
Oh, and I see now.
They can stay on the field from 4 to 6 minutes. I have them trained so as they can elude those who try to chase them. They couldn't catch my dog.
Well, now,
until they get about 2 or 3 extra commercials in.
Well, after they have stayed on the field and run around and evaded everybody, how do they know enough to come off the field?
I'm way in back of the hot dog stand with a very high whistle that only the dogs can hear. When I let that go, the dog comes right over. And then they all congratulate me for getting the dog off the field. So it works both ways. I get congratulations from the referee and kudos from the advertising agency.
I see. When's your first game this year?
September 15th.
Well, that's good, and I hope you have a lot of success with it.
Thank you
very much. We'll be looking for your efforts out there.
Thanks, Ray.
We'll see them. Bob. No doubt.
Our agricultural spotlight is one of the directors of the Lackawanna Field Station, our old friend Dean Archer Armstead. Dean, if you'd just swivel the chair around so that you're facing into the microphone, I'm sure we get a lot more out of this.
Well, thank you very much.
Heaven knows it's difficult enough.
I am just recently returned from a seminar that we held up in New York State.
And I was going to ask you about that because I know that they introduced a great many of the new innovations in haying. One is that square baler.
That's right. We're trying to show the advantages to the farmer of using this machine.
I see. Well, what are some of the advantages? Can you
pinpoint them? You need not to cut your hay and then wait for it to dry. What you do is you let your hay dry naturally
on the
ground before you cut it. Mm-hmm. But there's one machine. And, don't move that.
In other words, they cut the hay, they leave it on the ground as it's cut, and then this baler goes
around. This machine cuts it, bales it, and then stacks it neatly. As it goes along, it saves so many steps and makes the hay farmer's life a lot more easy.
I should imagine. Well, now, of course, we're coming into fall, and this is going to be mulching season. Can you give any tips on that for the farmers who...
Well, I'd like to sum it up this way, Bob. When in doubt, mulch. By that, I mean you can never overmulch. And now certainly the season when another week, when the summer will definitely be on the wane.
Sure. Well, okay, Dean, and we'll be looking for you as a regular feature in the weeks ahead. I hope that everything up at the experimental station is going according to Hoyle, and that you have success with the things you're working on.
I certainly hope so, and I know it will appreciate by a minute. Good afternoon, everyone.
Dean, out your arms.
Well, this week, I suppose you're wondering, where has Wally Ballou gone? Well, we'll tell you. He's in Grand Junction, Colorado, where he's interviewing businessmen, small businessmen. And as we look in on him now in a tape report, this is one he sent back earlier this week, he was talking with a shoe repairman. So come in, Wally Ballou.
This is Walt Ballou speaking to you from Salvatore Bagatelli's shoe repair shop. Mr. Bagatelli has told me that he can take a few moments out to explain just what he is trying to do here and how business is from a small standpoint. Mr. Bagatelli?
When will I hang up my leather apron? I'll be right there.
I'm standing about 6 feet in from the door which leads to
now
the street.
About that.
And I'm just filling there. Mr. Bagatelli, how many shoes do you repair in a day?
I can put soles on 20 shoes. I can put soles and heels on 15 shoes. I can put just heels on almost 35 shoes.
Is that pairs or singles, sir?
Well, actually on the heels it would be 34 and a half. And here at my shop I insist that my men do the right shoe first and then the left shoe, just so that we can stack them up on the shelves in proper order and sequence.
I see great banks of machinery behind you.
That's right. Those are trimmers and cutters, filer downers, and like that.
I see. How long have you been in this small business of repairing shoes?
I've been doing this for a good many years. It's nothing new for me, being a shoe repairman. I've gone through a whole different range of shoe styles down through the years.
Hey,
I don't...
something just caught my eye over here on the ready rack.
Yeah.
This little set of tiny shoes can't be more than 3-4 inches long. They're not children's shoes. They're not grown-up shoes. Whose shoes are those?
Well, these little shoes here,
yeah.
they were in for...
With the turned-up toes on them, with a little bell.
Sold, and here a little fella comes in from the hills. He wears a little hat, funny hat, and a green suit made out of velvet. He comes in here about once a year and has these shoes fixed up, puts soles and heels on them.
Does he have an antenna on his head?
He has a funny thing on the top of his head, yes.
Well, have you noticed anything unusual about him? By that I mean...
Well, he doesn't speak English, I know that. He just comes in and grunts a few orders to me, and he has an unusual-looking gun, sidearm type of thing. It looks like a flashlight, but I see him wither a lot of flowers as he walks down the street with it.
Might be kind of a disintegrator ray, huh?
I don't know whatever that would be, but he's a funny little fella, and I don't mess with him.
Well, you mind your own business, Mr. Bagatelli.
You mind your own, too.
No, Clark. I didn't mean you. I mean that's a good philosophy to follow. And now this is Walt Ballou returning you to Bob and Ray in New York.
Now, once again, time to call in Wally Ballou, who is at an egg-dyeing factory up in New York State. So come in, Wally Ballou, at Rensselaer, New York.
Ballou at Rensselaer, New York. And here it's a scene of activity as eggs are being dyed various colors in their fine shells. And everybody is just having a wonderful time. Manager of the plant has just given an order to a line of egg dyers over at the fireside. Now he's coming over to our microphone.
Hello, I'm Marvin Naismith.
Mr. Naismith, we've just been marveling at the activity of the gay panorama of colors that greeted our eye when we stepped inside here.
Well, it's a happy scene as we dye these eggs every year. I'd like to point out, of course, that the dyes we use are quite poisonous.
That is probably something you don't want to advertise too strongly.
I'd like to keep this just between you and myself and whatever network you're on. I might point out that I've invited along the stockholders in my organization for this broadcast, and obviously they approve of my straightforwardness in announcing promptly that the dyes we use are poisonous.
Well, your eggs then aren't sold for consumption in any way.
No, they're more for just rolling on the lawn or for just looking at about 20 feet. I would not advise...
You mean they're dangerous if you get within 20 feet of them?
You should not handle them unless you're wearing gloves, and I would recommend steel gloves of some sort.
Well, I notice that all of those people over there are wearing coverall-type uniforms with headgear that covers their whole head.
That's all lead-lined, all uniforms. You can't go near these eggs unless you're very well protected from them. That's right.
You find you have quite a lot of satisfied users for your product?
Yes, we have... We have a list every year. We send out about 12 people by these who own, fortunately, lead uniforms that enables them to have fun with these eggs at this time.
Uh-huh. Well, now here is the familiar ceremony, which I understand is set here at your factory. The ceremony you pull off every year about this time when you... toss the eggs into the moat outside the factory.
That's right. And then they float down across the pond and are gathered over there by a group of co-workers who ship them in lead automobiles and trucks down to New York and other large metropolitan population centers here in the East, Midwest, Far West, South, North.
We've certainly enjoyed talking to you, Mr. Naismith, and I hope that we'll be able to come back and find next year that your business has increased a great deal.
Good luck to you, too.
And Donut Week is with us again. And in celebration, we've dispatched Wally Ballou to a donut factory here to find out what makes donuts tick. Come in, Wally Ballou.
Wally Ballou speaking to you from a typical donut factory just outside of Newark, New Jersey, where donuts are being made by the thousands. Donuts which we'll be eating at our breakfast tables or what have you, probably early this week. I'd like to speak with the manager of this donut factory and see if we can find out if... Sir, would you come over here, please?
Welcome to the donut factory, Mr. Ballou. It's always a pleasure to meet you and your friendly cohorts.
Sure to meet you too, sir. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what's going on here.
Well, we're standing right here now. We're making up a batch of bread donuts and knocking the middles out of them. You can prod this lady.
What happens to those middles, incidentally? It's a question that's been asked of me quite a few times.
Well, we roll them up into a big ball and make more donuts and then knock the middle out of them again.
And then you have a few little...
Then we have a little ball left. We roll that in, make some more donuts and knock the middle out of that. And finally, what's left kind of disappears like...
What? Well, what do you do with that? You probably get down to one left, don't you?
Well, that's right. To turn on the machine, Eddie, we can't waste a minute.
Right.
What we do is the little bits, we fry them off, and they're like squares.
Uh-huh.
And we pass them around to the factory here while the visitor's going through.
Interesting. You've got the place decked out with colored bunting, too, I see.
That's right. This week we'll be making all kinds of donuts, jelly donuts filled with cream, some of them with sugar on them, some of them with icing, vanilla icing, chocolate icing, orange icing, lime icing.
Okay, there. Thanks very much for this visit and this interesting discussion of how donuts are made. Wally Ballou returning you to New York.
Well, we thought it might be nice and interesting today to get a cross-section of views on the coming holiday down on the street. So.
That's right, and so we thought we'd call in correspondent W. Ballou, who's down there.
W. Ballou, standing here at the corner of Rockefeller Plaza and 49th Street in good old Manhattan, or New York City. Going to see if I can take somebody out. The traffic is... pretty well styled up and not moving whatsoever. Let me go over here by this sleigh pulled up here. How about you, sir? Would you have a few words while you're parked there?
Yes, very glad to.
Very nice to see you. You look as if you're in a holiday mood.
Yes, I am.
What strikes you most about Christmas this year in Manhattan?
Well, the lack of snow.
That makes a pretty tough
start
with that
sleigh. Well, there's enough snow for a sleigh, you see.
Uh-huh.
That's been the big problem with me. I like to travel around in this sleigh with my reindeer.
I noticed you had eight of them there.
Yes, that's the Pinto. That's the...
the Nina?
Nina. And the Maria there.
Uh-huh.
And so forth.
That suit you're wearing...
That's red. That's imitation white ermine. The cuffs are around the neck.
And you laugh like a bowl full of jelly there, I notice.
Well, that's what they say.
What do you do, sir? What line of work you in?
I'm in the toy business. Primarily, I deliver toys at this time of the year to children in my world.
I see. Well, I see the traffic is beginning to move, and hope you'll be able to get through okay.
Well, I hope so, and I want to thank you for coming by. Is this been on the radio?
Yes, it has. You got a cold?
Little bit. Yes.
Okay, good luck to you, sir.
Notice how I laugh like a bowl of jelly?
Yeah. This is Wally Ballou returning you to...
I wanted to say order a glass of beer. How would I go about that?
Well, I think that's very simple. You'd indicate to the gentleman behind the bar your desires. I think that would be the easiest way. If he didn't hear you, then you might yell to him to get his attention.
All right, does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Any other questions?
My question is this, like when my after I've been overhauling a cable, like, and my hands are all dirty, when I meet a lady, do I shake hands with her, you know?
It's the correct thing to...
Well, should I say, well, I'd shake hands with you, lady, but I've been overhauling a cable and my hands are filthy.
No, I think you can overcome the problem very graciously and very easily if you should wash your hands thoroughly with soap and water before...
Soap and water.
Before meeting the lady at the appointed place.
I see.
Then you can shake hands or whatever.
Uh-huh.
But it would be correct before your date to have the hands washed with soap.
Well, if it's a regular date, I mean, not a girl, and...
It doesn't make any difference.
Well, I mean, it's just a strange lady that I just met. I mean, what would I do? I hope I'm...
Well, you're not quite making yourself clear, sir.
Well, let's say I just finished overhauling this here cable.
Yes, all right.
And I come up, and a friend of mine says, Freddie, I'd like you to meet so-and-so. It's a lady. And what would I do? I mean, shake hands with her or go wash my hands, like you say, with soap and water?
Well, you wouldn't, as soon as he said, I would like to have you meet my lady friend, you wouldn't immediately say, excuse me, I'm going to wash my hands with soap and water. You would say, how do you do? Try gracefully not to shake hands with her.
Well, nothing. If I have these dirty hands and I want to buy a tie, I mean, I go into a tie store,
no.
Do I dare...
No, I know.
Handle the ties.
No, you shouldn't touch your merchandise at all with those greasy hands.
All right, close up for me. Thank you.
Now, it's about all the question time we have, but if you'll be thinking of any more, the next time we're back here, we'll try to answer some more. Backstage here at the Leanhurst Theater in the dressing room of one of its... second stars, I would say, would be the correct phraseology, wouldn't it, Lawrence?
I hope so. I suppose it would be, yes.
When did this play open?
It opened Friday, and it closed Friday.
Oh, it's already closed. You're just here to pick up your clothes and things and...
Oh, that's right. We have to leave the costumes here because they don't belong to us, but...
Mm-hmm. How long have you rehearsed for us?
I have to get my shaving equipment and my own makeup kit.
How long did you rehearse for this play, The Good Seed?
Well, we went into rehearsal in February.
Mm-hmm.
And we rehearsed all summer.
I see. And then you had the part of a butler, as I understand it, didn't you?
That's right. The whole play, the mystery, hinged on a speech of mine in the third act.
Could you recall that speech for us?
Yes. I couldn't recall it during the play.
Well, I remember reading about that in the reviews. They said that you and quite a few of the others of the cast forgot lines.
Well, that probably was the biggest fault with the production, was that we all forgot our lines. And
didn't the opening night performance run something like 5.5 hours?
It was a little longer. The curtain went up at 9:20, and the show didn't let out till 1:50.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, you don't remember right now what that line was that the whole play hinged on that you forgot.
I'm trying to remember it now. I couldn't remember it at all. That's why the play was such a dismal failure.
You were supposed to come in and say who did it.
Yes, and I came in, and I pointed at all the suspects on the stage and said, they all did it.
And, of course, the man playing the police commissioner had no answer for that.
Well, he didn't remember his lines anyway. I wasn't... it was pretty frightening. And, of course, the critics had left during the first act.
Well, what are you going to do now, Lawrence? Will you be going back on Broadway?
No, I've had my fill of it.
I see. Thank you very much. So long from the Leanhurst Theater. How would you like to make extra money in your spare time? For a profitable hobby that can develop into a lucrative business, it's alligators, the small, clean, scaly animals that are literally worth their weight in gold.
Now, they can be raised in a spare room, basement, or garage. It takes only a few minutes a day to care for a pair, and it costs only a few pennies a day to feed each animal. Alligators breed once a year and have 1 to 5 eggs at a time. They wipe clean with a damp cloth.
Now, the pair that you're going to get from Alligator Industries are completely guaranteed, produces all pedigreed and registered. Now, we would like to point out that you can make all sorts of things from these animals, suitcases, shoes, watch bands, many other expensive articles.
Now, we'll help you get started, folks, and show you how to make substantial profits in alligator raising. We'll supply you with 2 alligator eggs and complete information on the feeding, raising, housing, and breeding of alligators.
Oh, and don't forget, Ray, alligator eggs are sturdy, they're easy to handle, and they're as light as ping pong balls.
Now then, for the free booklet on alligator raising, with no obligation whatsoever, write to Slimy, New York.
And as a special bonus for the first 100 to order alligator eggs, we're going to send absolutely free a 1-week supply of vitamin-enriched alligator food.
Remember, no alligator salesman will call at your home.
I just wish you could see our studio here, all bedecked with bunting of varied colors. And we're chatting with Miss Gladys Gayhart of Elkhart, Indiana. Just a minute, Miss Gayhart. We're introducing you. She is a member of the group here in convention in New York City. And having their actual convention here in the studio, Miss Gayhart, will you tell us just what it is that you folks collect?
Miniature wastebaskets, the tiniest type possible. And I have, to repeat, been collecting them now for 15 years.
You have your total collection right here on this board, bedecked with bunting and various decorative effects here. There must be, 8 or 9 there?
There are 12.
12 miniature wastebaskets.
And you see this one here, I'll point to it. Mm-hmm. That is all hand-carved leather.
Not much bigger than a thimble, is it?
That's reputed. No, it's actually smaller, I'd say, than the ordinary thimble. Now, this is reputed to be almost 3,000 years old.
Is that so? What did they do with the miniature wastebaskets 3,000 years ago?
Well, they threw tiny things in them.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, how many of you are here in convention at New York for this
weekend? There are 4 of us who collect these.
4 from various parts of the United States. And how
3
many?
From the United States, 1 from the British Isles.
Is that so? And what does the total collection include? How many miniature wastebaskets do you have?
About 19, including. And we think that there are 2 more somewhere in the world.
Isn't that interesting? I think that this is real
that
wonderful.
The dye on this, that purple and bluish.
Well, I see our time is up, Miss Gayhart. I hope you have a wonderful time here in New York, and thanks for talking on our microphone.
You're welcome.
Let's go to the Kalamazoo Zoo and W.W. Baloo.
W. Baloo at the Kalamazoo Zoo. And you may remember a few weeks ago, Captain Bart McAllister was our guest. The very same Captain McAllister, after a rather unfortunate accident with the boa constrictor, out of the hospital and back here with us today. Captain, how do you feel?
Pretty good, Bob, or what's your name?
Wally.
Wally.
You look as if you're in peak condition and fine shape.
Well, I'm still a little weak, but what I want to do is get my nerve back if I possibly can. This is my first day out of the hospital after letting that boa constrictor wrap himself around my chest. And usually I can throw them off by expanding my chest, but that fellow was particularly strong.
That was Long John, if I remember, was his name.
That's right.
And you do this three times a day at the Kalamazoo Zoo, is that right?
That's right. This is my first time back, though, and I hope to do
the first show.
First show, and then that's all for the day, and then tomorrow I'll take the regular three.
All right. Well, now, Long John is in this big crate over here, and you want to open it up, and we'll...
All right. Well, good to see you again, Long John.
Long John is nodding, and Captain McAllister is...
All right. He's wrapping himself around my chest now.
He does that automatically, doesn't he?
That's right. He's applying a little pressure now. Soon I'll expand my chest and flip him right off.
Well, this is one of the most daring feats of bravery in the...
Wait a minute. No, I'll just...
In any zoo that we've seen. Sorry that Marlon Perkins isn't here to view this today, too, with us. It's a scene of panoramic beauty as I stand here. Long John is... Captain?
No, help me.
Captain?
Get him on.
Captain?
Get him on me.
W.W. Baloo returning you.
Get him off! Get him out!
Well, here with us this morning is a man with a rather unusual hobby. I think you said your name was McGonagall, is that right?
That's right, I did.
That would be Tiki McGonagall, and what is this hobby of yours that has been
well,
so...
Well, it's hardly a hobby anymore, Mr.
Elliot.
It's my livelihood now. I'm sorry.
You devote your full time to this?
Then. Yes. Well, it's a full-time job. I train butterflies, and I use a whip.
You train butterflies with a whip?
That's right.
Well, now, just...
I'd like to point out that I never have hit one, because... If I hit a butterfly with a whip, I'd have an enemy for life.
In other words, it's somewhat like the lion tamer who goes into the cage with a chair and a blank cartridge pistol. You don't really intend to harm the animal, or do you call
it... I've never known a mean butterfly in my life.
How long have you been doing this, Sir Tiki?
Well, it started off as a kid when I first noticed butterflies, and I thought that maybe I could help them by teaching them things. Come and go and eat at certain regular intervals and to enjoy life a little more than flying around.
Well, I had always been under the impression that butterflies enjoyed themselves to the fullest without any help from humans.
Well, who was to say? You know. And I took it upon myself to instruct these little things, and it's worked out wonderfully for them and for me. I like them a lot.
You mean that the butterflies have changed in the last...
In the last 15, 20 years... Whereas, say, a butterfly born in 1911 could look forward to a year of life, now a butterfly born today can live 2 years, maybe.
Is that so? Is there any difference in size? Are they more
robust? They're bigger now. They're stronger butterflies than they used to be. And they're healthier generally, I think.
You told me just before we went on the air, too, that you thought they were taller now than they used to be.
Oh, yes, they're a good deal taller.
Well, what is all this
stronger? They withstand winds a lot better than they used to. They used to flop around in them.
Mm. What's all this going to lead to, Tiki? By that I mean, what do you plan to do after training as many butterflies as possible for you?
Well, there's nothing much to do with them, except start over with a new class. I'm starting a new class now. Bring in a new crowd.
I see.
through.
Well, thanks very much for coming up here with
you. You might notice that I ran around in a Roman chariot pulled by 12 of the most beautiful butterflies you've
ever seen. That's right, he does, ladies and gentlemen. And right now he's taking his net and going out through the huge studio doors here.
Bye, everybody.
In a chariot drawn by 14 beautiful butterflies. Thank you very much.
You're entirely welcome. Goodbye, everybody.
Just before we went on the air today, we selected a member of our studio audience who answered the question, what is my most exciting experience? And I think we have a lady who's had a very exciting one, Ms. Flannel. Is it Ms. or Ms.?
It's Ms. Flannel.
All right, Mother, well, will you tell us...
Now, just a moment.
Hmm?
Do not call me Mother. I hate this patronizing manner that so many radio and television masters of ceremonies have.
I understand.
If they have a lady over 30 years... Immediately call her Mother.
Well, it's gone
I
back through
to
the
it.
History of
I would
radio.
Much prefer you call me Ms. Flannel.
Well, all right, Ms. Flannel. What is your most exciting experience?
Well, it happened just barely 10 months ago. I was on a train between New York City and Albany, New York.
Yes?
We were gone about 15, 20 minutes, just up above West Point, riding along, when suddenly I couldn't believe my eyes. Riding down from the hill country to our left, I could discern a group of Indians. And they were armed with rifles of gold. And they attacked the plane.
Indians attacked the plane?
Everybody seek cover! Bend down as low as you can. Get away from the window.
We were so
Sorry
excited.
To you, Bob and Ray. Oh, there she is. Come along, Ma Flannel, now.
Oh, there's
Come
the nice doctor. Well, Bob and Ray, I have to run along now.
Say goodbye. Come along.
Goodbye, everybody.
Right this way.
Who was that fella?
I don't know, but he sure ruined a perfectly wonderful dramatic bit there.
She had me really believing that for a while.
Well, me too, and she had the dramatic department all warmed up, the sound effects and everything. Oh, well.
Hey, boy, have we got a terrific announcement to make now, huh?
That's right, folks. Bob and Ray have another blockbuster for you.
Remember we've told you about the big warehouse that's always bursting with war surplus bargains?
Well, last night it burst, and what a mess. But our loss is your gain. We have exactly 164 bayonets complete with scabbards, which were never used in the war.
They were sent back from Cuba right after the Battle of San Juan Hill, absolutely untouched.
And that's not all. We have 226 pair of canvas leggings, which were only used once at the Battle of San Juan Hill.
What's more, these leggings were used only going up the hill, not down.
And we have 314 pair of heavy-duty campaign boots, sizes 12, 14, and 17. Now, some of these pairs match, and all of them have only slight mud stains from San Juan Hill.
That's not all. We have 36 flagpoles, which fit the hand perfectly. If you have a flag and plan to run up San Juan Hill waving it on your vacation, don't miss this bargain.
Hey, listen to this, too, fans. We have left exactly 22 slightly used ammunition wagons, which were damaged just a bit when they slid back down San Juan Hill. A few nails here and there, some bicycle tape, a coat of paint, a little grease, and you can take your own ammunition wagon with you during your vacation.
And finally, we have 124 full cases of canned corned beef, which are clearly stamped San Juan Hill 1898 on the tops of the cans. Now, if you do not find this corned beef all you hope it to be, just leave word for the executor of your estate to return the remaining unopened cans to us.
So if you want to snap up some of these terrific war surplus bargains, you just write today to Teddy Roosevelt, care of New York.
Once again, it's Bob and Ray Lucky Phone Call time when we select a number scientifically from our phone books of various cities throughout the United States and call the lucky one who is selected. Ray, have you picked out the city, first of all?
Well, the lucky city, Bob, is right here. Looks like Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Lancaster, Pennsylvania, eh, Ray? And if you'll hand me the number there, I'll dial it. Our operators are standing by ready to put the call right through.
6682.
Okay. And it's buzzing now. I hope they're home because this is a lucky phone call.
Hello?
Hello.
Mike Ziemer?
No, this is Leo Plumeritis.
Well, we were calling Lancaster 36682.
That's right.
Have we the right number?
That's right. I just moved into this house just recently.
Oh, I see. Well, Mr. Ziemer must be out then.
This is my house.
Oh.
This is the Plumeritis household now.
Bob and Ray calling from New York.
How do you do?
This is our lucky phone call for today.
Wild, isn't that wonderful?
It certainly is, and you realize...
This is a lucky phone call. Looks like we've won something.
Wonder if you realize how many chances, how big the odds are that we should happen to pick you, Mr. Plumeritis.
Well, I imagine out of the millions of registered phones in America to have you call me, the odds would be pretty staggering.
We have them all here on our... Is Ms. Plumeritis there with you?
Well, she's busy right now.
Uh-huh.
She's putting some icing on the cake.
We have all of our phone numbers here on the stage. And we picked them scientifically, as you know, if you've ever heard
of
them.
I know, we've been listening. I'm an apple dipper down here. I make candy apples. Daddy's our big day. I dip them here in the kitchen.
It's a big seller in the fall, isn't it? Around Thanksgiving and Halloween time.
My wife would like to know what we won.
What?
My wife, she wants to know what we won.
Well, you didn't win anything, sir. We just happened to call you, and the odds are so great that you are lucky that it was you.
Huh?
And we want to wish you all the very best, and thank you for talking to us today over the telephone. Been a real pleasure, Mr. Plumeritis, and you'll hear from us by mail.
Well, thank you.
We'll inform you by letter.
Oh, yes,
I am. You're our lucky phone caller.
It is unusual.
Right on. Bye, bye.
Well, you know, there's been an awful lot of talk about the government projecting off into space a new satellite, a moon type of satellite.
Not to be outdone, we at Bob and Ray Laboratories have been quite busy in the last week or two.
Well, actually, we didn't do all the work at the laboratories. It was down in my cellar, and we have made up a satellite sun so that we hope, because of the weather this week, we won't be able to project it, but we hope soon to have the sunshine 24 hours a day, folks.
We're going to launch it from the famous Bob and Ray Zeppelin, which was featured in a show that flopped a few years ago, the Zeppelinorama, that we were behind at the time.
Now, Bob, you have the technical details there on the lights that are going to go into this satellite, and...
Well, I don't want to get too technical, because it does run into...
For those who listen, who are scientifically bent, maybe they will glean something from this.
Yes. Well, I hope you're listening then. It's going to be powered. Well, not powered, actually. No, I'm using the wrong word.
Yeah.
It's going to have something like 16 to 20 candles inside this thing that's about the size of a beach ball.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to send it off the first of next week, and we hope that... we'll be able to tell you more about it. Maybe you'll be able to see it out there in space. You know, space is way out there, and it's way out.
And if we can get it out there, we also hope to man it. We want to send Wally Ballou with it. I haven't spoken to him about it yet, but if he will go, we're certainly all
ready. That's right. We hope to fill the satellite with two lights that will burn all the time and Wally Ballou.
And the only problem right now is to get it round. We've got little lumps in this thing. The satellite, and if we can smooth those off and make it round, it'll probably work much better, we think.
So,
but that's enough.
We don't want you to think that we haven't been keeping up with science, folks, here at the Bob and Ray Laboratory, so you keep watching the sky.
If you see a bright light, it'll be that. Child psychology from a Zickening point of view. Dr. Horace W. Zickening here with us in our studio. We have quite a lot of mail that's piled up here, and I want to get right to the questions from Tucson, Arizona. Mrs. Leipzig McGee writes that her son would like to become a movie star. He's 4 years old. How can I explain to him why this would be impossible?
Well,
maybe you don't think it would be impossible, Doctor.
I'd tell this woman that this child of 4 years has hardly reached the age of reason. So she would have to talk slowly. And this I recommend in all cases. Never raise the voice when you're speaking to a child. It only frightens him. Explain to him in simple language how at 4 years it's impossible for him to become a movie star. Mm-hmm. Explain it over to him several times so that you're sure he understands.
In other words, that the long climb to Hollywood fame, mm-hmm. to through dramatic lessons and screen tests and so forth, would be well out of his reach.
That's right. And then if he persisted in this desire, whack him.
All right. Well, Doctor, I think we have maybe time for one more here. This is from Mr. Farbinger Thirkel, who says his son, Farbinger Thirkel, Jr., this is similar to the other case, would like to become a sheep herder, and all the time is talking about that. What can he do?
Certainly that one has humorous overtones. Yeah, how old is this young fellow?
He's 8.
Wants to be a sheep herder. Here again, it's a simple case of explaining to the boy that sheep herding isn't all that it probably is painted to be, that the remuneration probably isn't too great, and that there are other handicaps of being a sheep herder, as we know. Explain to him also that probably by the time he reaches 21... he probably wouldn't be interested in it. Explain to him in a quiet voice and try to make as much sense as possible to him. And then if he still persists, whack him!
Well, what do they do at a remote rural firehouse? We thought now you might be interested in hearing a cribbage game being played at the Ogunquit, Maine Fire Department firehouse.
Molly Ballou speaking. And the game has been on now for about 2 hours. And so far, it's a tie, four games to four.
It's my crib, Sergeant.
That's right. There you are.
Okay, throw away. Throw these away. You
You're
cut.
Quit, huh?
Yeah, you cut.
Okay.
Oh, there's a jack. I get two
one
for that.
Yeah, you'll need it. Let's see. 8.
15 for 2.
And another 7, 22 for 2.
25.
31, 2. I got 15, 2. 15.
I get one for the last card there.
Oh, yeah. 15, 2, 15, 4.
2.
8 or 12.
15, 6.
You don't need to look at mine. You can take my word for it.
19.
The two players of the playoff here.
19 on that
counting
one.
Counting each other's hands. The left-hand player just got 19. And that would make
You can't have 19.
Somebody said he can't have 19.
That's my wife, Mr. Ballou.
What do you have to butt in on it for?
No.
It looks as if a fight may start at any moment.
See, I'll count again. 15-2, 15-4.
How to get up again?
15-6. Run of 3 is 9. 2 is 11 and 10. 7, 8, 9, 10, 15. No.
You know how to count. That's your big trouble.
Well, sir, 15-2, 15-4, 15-6. Run of 3 is 9. 15.
All you got is 8 there.
Now let's see. 15.
And I got 12, and that puts me out.
Wait just a minute.
See him? Count them. Go on, count them there.
Well, let's see. You have 15, 2. Well, I can see 8. I don't see where you get 12 out of that.
See them 4 there?
Now, listen
to me. 2 pair. That makes 4.
Wait just a minute. I've been playing cribbage here with you for a good many years. You ought to start getting happy with me.
12 put me out.
We'll have a further report on who the winner was at a later time.
And here with us, the man with rather an interesting job that we picked out of the audience just a few moments ago. Mr. Bird, I think your name is. Is that right?
Yes.
B-Y or B-I-R-D?
B-Y.
What'd you put it in?
Fleming.
Fleming Bird. Do you mind if I call you Fleming?
Certainly.
Mr. Bird, you work in a fingernail clipper factory, is that right, as a tester?
That's right, sir. I test the fingernail clipper itself, edge, the sharp edge, see if it cuts.
I've seen these advertisements saying that each clipper has been tested. How do you go about that, sir? How do you do it?
Well, I clip.
Don't use your own fingernail.
Yes, I do.
Do you really?
Yes. I, of course, can only test 12 a day that way.
Well,
clippers.
I see. And you're going to... That doesn't make very much of an output, then. You're not the only tester there, are you?
Yes, I am.
So when you work a five-day week, that's 60 clippers a week they turn out.
See, 12 times 5.
60.
12 twos are 24. 12.
No, it's 2 fives are 10. 1 five is 5 and carry 1 there.
60.
Make 60.
That'd be 60 a week.
That's right. And they get a quarter a piece for them?
Yes, 25 cents a piece they get for them.
That's $15, isn't it?
Well, let's see, 25.
Well, listen, this isn't important. I wanted you to actually test one.
Wait a second. 25 times... What was that figure you had?
Well, sir, our time is a little bit valuable here. We don't have all day.
25 times 5. 5 fives would be...
I just don't. I was thinking the economics of
would
the thing.
Would you carry a 2 there?
Yes, I think so.
Would.
Now, will you test one of these clippers? I'd like to see you do that.
Well, I saved one thing now so I could test it.
One hand, you mean?
Yes.
All right. There. That's one.
And now another.
That does work. Good. Now, can you tell at this point whether the clipper is in good shape?
Yes. These three have been fine now.
Right.
The fourth one.
Mm-hmm.
Now the fifth one. And the sixth one.
Well, there you have an actual demonstration of how these fingernail clippers are tested. Thank you very much, Fleming Bird.
What's that, 25 times 5?
Yeah, I'll get with you. Oh, yeah. Happy to welcome back today, and especially with the additional network affiliations that we have, the Regional Coordinator of Interbureau Administration for the Northeast States, Clyde L. Whartney, or Hap, as he is known to us here. Hap, it's a pleasure to see you again.
First of all, Bob, I want to thank you, your employers, and the entire network for making this time available to me and my office absolutely free.
Hap, I know a great many things have taken place down at the Interbureau Coordination Administration
since we've
seen you, and I wonder if you'd bring us up to date a little bit.
Well, as you know, we have an office here in New York. We have a field office in Rutland, Vermont, and we cover the 6 New England states, Pennsylvania, and Indiana. And it's our hope to be opening shortly, field office in Muncie, Indiana.
Excuse me. Go ahead.
Oh, you go ahead.
You still have quite a sizable number of men in the field reporting in on a weekly or biweekly basis. I wonder if you'd tell us how the cooperation with your administrators in the field has been.
The cooperation has been excellent. However, the morale at my office is at a low ebb. As you know...
Would you like me to hold that ice cream cone for you?
No, this is all right. Thank you.
All right.
As you know... we have not had any money forthcoming from Washington. We've been functioning now for over a year. Now, that's so that when I get into the office on, well, say Monday morning now, I'll get these shifty glances from all the employees because they haven't been paid in over a year. I've made several trips to Washington to find out who my immediate supervisor is. Nobody seems to know.
Well, you're still working on the basis of Army directives, isn't that right?
We have one office here, and then we have about 12 folding chairs,
mm-hmm.
One desk, a phone, and a complete list of Army regulations. So that's the only book that we have to go by.
Well, in other words, you haven't been able to get any satisfaction. Go ahead.
I haven't been able to get any satisfaction down in Washington as to where the money's going to come from.
Well, I can imagine that there should be
I'm an optimist at heart, and because of that, I've gone ahead and leased 4 more floors in the building where I am, and have taken on 250 more employees who will be typing the records that our field men will be bringing
in. And
you're
still coordinating, collating the records, sending them on to Washington on a regular basis.
Sending it on to Washington on a regular basis.
So that they will know what you're doing.
So they'll know what we're doing down there.
All right, sir. Well, thank you very much for bringing us up to date. And anything further that you have to report, make sure that you bring it to us first, will you please? Clyde L. Hap Whartney of the Interbureau Regional Coordination Administration for the Northeast States, Pennsylvania, and Indiana.
Let me have 15 cents to get home.
We call in correspondent Wally Ballou at the Detergent Box Derby, Uphill Falls, Oregon.
W. Ballou at the Detergent Box Derby, as we have reason to believe you've been told that they push these little wagons that they have built themselves up this hill.
Yes, correction here, Wally.
Here's Ivy Hammerhart, ladies and gentlemen.
Point out that rather than mislead the public, they
All these kids did not fill these themselves. They could have help from their fathers. I think that it's probably proper that we mention that, Wally.
Lulu, from my vantage point, a scene of panoramic beauty spread out up ahead of me. And you're right, Artie. And as a matter of fact, looking over these little cars, I would say that in 90% of the cases, the old man made it for the youngster.
Just a correction on your figures. Before we went on the air, Wally, I took time out to check with the chairman of the Derby. He tells me that there are only forefathers, actually, who helped any of these kids.
Well, considering there are only five in the race, I would say that was pretty near 90%.
Well, actually, it wouldn't be 90%, you know. If you know your mathematics, Wally, that would be one...
Excuse me just a minute, Artie. I think it's been made known to you now that out of the five who started, only four are expected to finish. One dropped out.
Well, true. However, I think I was still correct, Wally, in saying that there were five contestants vying for the honors here at the Cajun Rock Derby.
Well, at that time, yes. When I said 90% of the contestants' cars had been built by their fathers, and there were five, and I was wrong. But now, actually, 100% of the four contestants still in the running cars were built by their fathers. That's all I can say about it.
Right, and I think probably the term running is wrong, Wally. You know, these are just regular boxes, and there is no motor in them,
and
well, they're pushed uphill. So
right.
I think when you say running in the race, I think that's the...
running is used as a purely rhetorical phrase.
That's right.
I didn't mean that the cars are running by themselves or under any power for anybody else.
Well, it's just that the lungs are on the air, and people would like to know exactly what's going on. I think if you used a better choice of words,
here's
it probably would
just happen. Here's a note just added to me. It says, get on with the description of this detergent box derby, and I think that's a good idea. Take it away, Artie Skeverheid.
Thank you, Wally Ballou, for my vantage point. They're now about a third way up the uphill falls. This hill rises about 700 feet. They started, scarcely 40 minutes ago. I would estimate that they have accomplished probably 300 yards. All these little fellas who are...
Well, just a minute, Artie Skeverheid. The entire race is only 280 yards. Therefore, they couldn't have accomplished 300 yards at this time.
Now, look, Wally, if you'd care to take just a little time out to take a look at the map that was handed to both of us by the committee here.
I have the map right here.
All right, just take a look at it now. Does that look like 200 yards to you, fella?
Hey, it looks like 200, but I'm told it's 280 yards, and I don't think there's any need to argue about it while we're on the air.
Well, I don't think it's... you do. Every time we do a remote broadcast, you try to make an idiot out of me, Wally.
I'm not trying to make any idiot out of you, Artie, any more than you're already doing. When you say the 280 yards is the same as 200 or 300.
Go ahead, Wally.
That's all I have to say from my vantage point.
Oh, that's all you have to say.